Installing an operating system. You might think that installing an operating system would be a simple procedure. And you'd be right. However, you really should know what you're doing before you undertake this process. Even if you already know how to do it, it's always nice to have a refresher course. The first thing you should before installing a new operating system is to back up your existing data. These programs basically take a picture image of everything on your hard drive. With them, you can restore your entire system even if your new OS doesn't leave a trace of your old OS. To effectively and safely back up your system, it's always a good idea to get some type of software program that will accomplish this. You could try doing it yourself, but these programs make it much, much easier. Consider one of the following. Acronic True Image 10 Home. Acronic True Image 10 Home creates the exact copy of your hard disk and allows you to instantly restore the entire machine, including operating system, applications, and all the data in the event of a fatal system crash or virus attack. No reinstallations required. With the new version, you also can easily back up your music, video, and digital photos, as well as Outlook emails, contacts, calendar, tasks, and user settings with just a few mouse clicks. Copy your entire PC, including the operating system, applications, user settings, and all data using patented disk imaging technology, back up your music, video, and digital photos, back up your Outlook emails, contacts, calendar, tasks, etc., and restore all settings for Microsoft Office, iTunes, Media Player, and dozens of popular applications. A free trial copy of this software can be downloaded at http://www.acronic.com/homecomputing/products/trueimage/. Norton Ghost. Made by Symantec Corporation, the same people who make and distribute Norton Antivirus, Norton Ghost is award-winning backup software. You should know, however, that this software is only for Microsoft Windows XP and 2000 operating systems. Like True Image, Ghost will save everything on your computer safely and efficiently. It will back up everything on your system, including music, pictures, applications, settings, etc., in one easy step. It can also recover your system and data even when you can't restart your operating system. You can download a free trialware version of Norton Ghost at www.symantec.com/home_homeoffice/products/overview.jsp. PSID equals BR and PVD equals Ghost 10. SOS Online Backup. With SOS Online Backup, you can start small, protecting a handful of really important files, and scale all the way up to 100 GB. It keeps previous versions of files forever. And continuous backup means your files are always backed up. It handles open files and performs continuous and scheduled backup. SOS backs up only differences for changed files and stores unlimited versions. It also has online access and file sharing. A free trial version can be downloaded at www.sosonlinibackup.com. Ghost for Linux. If you are currently using Linux for your operating system and want to switch to another one, this is the program for you. Like other backup software programs, Ghost for Linux is a cloning tool and was created by Symantec, the folks who brought us Norton Antivirus. Your drive will be cloned using the Click and Clone tool. It has been said to be easy to use and very efficient. A downloadable version of Ghost for Linux can be found at www.linux.softpedia.com/git/system/hardware/ghost-for-linux053.html. Once you have all of your files backed up and you are sure the disk contains all of your information, you'll then be ready to install your system. This is the easiest process of all. If you have purchased an OS such as Windows, it will come with an installation disk. What you'll need to do is put the disk in your disk drive and then shut down your computer. Turn it back on, and the OS will begin installing from the boot. Follow any on-screen prompts and answer accordingly. If you have downloaded your new OS from a freeware site such as those that offer Linux for free, you will need to save the program to your computer's My Documents area. Once it has downloaded, go to My Documents and double-click on the file. You will probably then be directed to answer questions as to how to proceed. Be aware that the installation process will probably take some time to complete. You need to monitor the progress, so expect to spend at least an hour during the install answering questions and watching it install. Once your new system is installed, you should spend some time going through its features and performing tasks that you would normally do. Make sure that all your previous functions work. Keep in mind that if you have had certain programs and applications on your computer prior to the reinstall, you will have to put them back on after the install. For example, if you had a favorite game on the computer before, you will have lost it with the reboot. You will have to reinstall the game if you want to play it. That's it for installing an operating system. It really is quite a simple process, but it can be time-consuming, so be prepared before you proceed. Now let's take a look at some of the functions contained in an operating system and what they mean. Sometimes computer terminology can be a bit confusing, so it's helpful to know what certain functions are all about. Defining the processes. Cache. When shopping for a computer, often the word cache will come up. There are two types of caches when it comes to modern computers, L1 and L2. Some now even have L3 caches. Caching is a very important process when it comes to your PC. There are memory caches, hardware and software disk caches, page caches and more. Virtual memory is even a form of caching. Let's look at what caching is and why it is so important. Caching is a technology based on the memory subsystem of your computer. The main purpose of a cache is to accelerate your computer while keeping the price of the computer low. Caching allows you to do your computer tasks more rapidly. To understand the basic idea behind a cache system, we can use a simple analogy using a librarian to demonstrate the caching process. Think of a librarian behind the desk. He or she is there to give you the books you ask for. To keep it simple, let's assume that you can't get the books yourself. You have to ask the librarian for the book you want to read and he or she gets it from you from shelving in the storeroom. This first example is a librarian without a cache. The first person arrives and asks for the book Great Expectations. The librarian goes to the storeroom, gets the book, returns to the counter, and gives the book to the customer. Later, the borrower comes back to return the book. The librarian takes the book and returns it to the storeroom, returning to the counter to wait for the next customer. The next customer comes in and also asks for Great Expectations. The librarian has to return to the storeroom to get the same book he had already handled and give it to the client. So basically, the librarian has to make a complete round trip to fetch every book, even very popular ones that are requested frequently. This isn't a very efficient system for our librarian, is it? However, there is a way to improve on this system. We can add a cache on the librarian. To illustrate a cache, let's give the librarian a backpack into which he or she will be able to store, say, 10 books. That would mean the librarian has a 10-book cache. In this backpack, he or she will put the books the customers returned to him up to a maximum of 10. Now, let's go back and visit the first scenario with our cached librarian. At the beginning of the day, the librarian's cache is empty. The first person arrives and asks for Great Expectations. So the librarian goes to the storeroom and gives it to the customer. When the customer returns with the book, instead of going back to the storeroom, the librarian puts the book into the backpack, making sure it isn't full first. Another person arrives and asks for Great Expectations. Before going to the storeroom, the librarian checks to see if the book is in the backpack already. Lo and behold, it is. Now all he or she has to do is take the book from the backpack and give it to the client. No extra energy is expended by the librarian, and the customer doesn't have to wait for that trip to the storeroom. Let's assume that the customer asks for a title that's not in the backpack. In this case, the librarian is less efficient with a cache because he or she must take the time to look for the book in the backpack first. That is why one of the challenges of cache design is to minimize the impact of cache searches. Modern hardware has reduced this time delay to practically zero. The time it takes for the librarian to look in the cache is much less than having to run to the storeroom, so time is saved automatically with a cache. The cache is small, Just 10 books, so the time it takes to notice a miss is only a tiny fraction of the time it takes to walk to the storeroom. From this example, you can see several important facts about caching. Cache technology is the use of a faster but smaller memory type to accelerate a slower but larger memory type. When using a cache, you must check the cache to see if an item is in there. If it is there, it's called a cache hit. If not, it is called a cache miss, and the computer must wait for a round trip from the larger, slower memory area. A cache has some maximum size that is much smaller than the larger storage area. It is possible to have multiple layers of cache. With our librarian example, the smaller but faster memory type is the backpack, and the storeroom represents the larger and slower memory type. This is a one-level cache. There might be another layer of cache consisting of a shelf that can hold 100 books behind the counter. The librarian can check the backpack, then the shelf, and then the storeroom. This would be a two-level cache. A computer is a machine in which we measure time in very small increments. When the microprocessor accesses the main memory, RAM, it does it in about 60 nanoseconds, 60 billionths of a second. That's pretty fast, but it is much slower than the typical microprocessor. Microprocessors can have cycle times as short as 2 nanoseconds, so to a microprocessor 60 nanoseconds seems like an eternity. What if we build a special memory bank in the motherboard, small but very fast, around 30 nanoseconds? That's already 2 times faster than the main memory access. That's called a level 2 cache or an L2 cache. What if we build an even smaller but faster memory system directly into the microprocessor's chip? That way, this memory will be accessed at the speed of the microprocessor and not the speed of the memory bus. That's an L1 cache, which on a 233 MHz Pentium is 3.5 times faster than the L2 cache, which is 2 times faster than the access to main memory. Some microprocessors have 2 levels of cache built right into the chip. In this case, the motherboard cache, the cache that exists between the microprocessor and main system memory, becomes level 3, or L3 cache. There are a lot of subsystems in a computer. You can put cache between many of them to improve performance. Here's an example. We have the microprocessor, the fastest thing in the computer. Then there's the L1 cache that caches the L2 cache that caches the main memory, which can be used, and is often used, as a cache for even slower peripherals like hard disks and CD-ROMs. The hard disks are also used to cache an even slower medium, your internet connection. Your internet connection is the slowest link in your computer. So your browser, Internet Explorer, Netscape, etc., uses the hard disk to store HTML pages, putting them into a special folder on your disk. The first time you ask for an HTML page, your browser renders it and a copy of it is also stored on your disk. The next time you request access to this page, your browser checks if the date of the file on the internet is newer than the one cached. If the date is the same, your browser uses the one on your hard disk instead of downloading it from internet. In this case, the smaller but faster memory system is your hard disk and the larger and slower one is the internet. Cache can also be built directly on peripherals. Modern hard disks come with fast memory, around 512 kilobytes, hardwired to the hard disk. The computer doesn't directly use this memory, the hard disk controller does. For the computer, these memory chips are the disk itself. The computer asks for data from the hard disk. The hard disk controller checks into this memory prior to moving the mechanical parts of the hard disk. This is very slow compared to memory. If it finds the data that the computer asked for in the cache, it will return the data stored in the cache without actually accessing data on the disk itself, saving a lot of time. Here's an experiment you can try. Your computer caches your floppy drive with main memory, and you can actually see it happening. Access a large file from your floppy, for example, open a 300 kilobyte text file in a text editor. The first time, you will see the light on your floppy turning on, and you will wait. The floppy disk is extremely slow, so it will take 20 seconds to load the file. Now, close the editor and open the same file again. The second time, don't wait 30 minutes or do a lot of disk access between the two tries, you won't see the light turning on, and you won't wait. The operating system checked into its memory cache for the floppy disk and found what it was looking for. So instead of waiting 20 seconds, the data was found in a memory subsystem much faster than when you first tried it. One access to the floppy disk takes 120 milliseconds, while one access to the main memory takes around 60 nanoseconds. That's a lot faster. You could have run the same test on your hard disk, but it's more evident on the floppy drive because it's so slow. To give you the big picture of it all, here's a list of a normal caching system. L1 cache, memory accesses at full microprocessor speed, 10 nanoseconds, 4 kilobytes to 16 kilobytes in size. L2 cache, memory access of type SRAM, around 20 to 30 nanoseconds, 128 kilobytes to 512 kilobytes in size. Main memory access of type RAM, around 60 nanoseconds, 32 megabytes to 128 megabytes in size. Hard disk, mechanical, slow, around 12 milliseconds, 1 gigabyte to 10 gigabytes in size. Internet, incredibly slow, between 1 second and 3 days, unlimited size. As you can see, the L1 cache caches the L2 cache, which caches the main memory, which can be used to cache the disk subsystems, and so on. One common question asked at this point is, why not make all of the computer's memory run at the same speed as the L1 cache, so no caching would be required? That would work, but it would be incredibly expensive. The idea behind caching is to use a small amount of expensive memory to speed up a large amount of slower, less expensive memory. In designing a computer, the goal is to allow the microprocessor to run at its full speed as inexpensively as possible. A 500 MHz chip goes through 500 million cycles in 1 second, one cycle every 2 nanoseconds. Without L1 and L2 caches, an access to the main memory takes 60 nanoseconds, or about 30 wasted cycles accessing memory. When you think about it, it is kind of incredible that such relatively tiny amounts of memory can maximize the use of much larger amounts of memory. Think about a 256 kilobyte L2 cache that caches 64 megabytes of RAM. In this case, 256,000 bytes officially caches 64 million bytes. Why does that work? In computer science, there is a theoretical concept called locality of reference. It means that in a fairly large program, only small portions are ever used at any one time. As strange as it may seem, locality of reference works for the huge majority of programs. Even if the executable is 10 megabytes in size, only a handful of bytes from that program are in use at any one time, and their rate of repetition is very high. Virtual memory. Virtual memory is a common part of most operating systems on desktop computers. It has become so common because it provides a big benefit for users at a very low cost. Most computers today have something like 32 or 64 megabytes of RAM available for the CPU to use. Unfortunately, that amount of RAM is not enough to run all of the programs that most users expect to run at once. For example, if you load the operating system, an email program, a web browser and word processor into RAM simultaneously, 32 megabytes is not enough to hold it all. If there were no such thing as virtual memory, then once you filled up the available RAM, your computer would have to say, "Sorry, you cannot load any more applications. Please close another application to load a new one." With virtual memory, what the computer can do is look at RAM for areas that have not been used recently and copy them onto the hard disk. This frees up space in RAM to load the new application. Because this copying happens automatically, you don't even know it is happening, and it makes your computer feel like it has unlimited RAM space even though it only has 32 megabytes installed. Because hard disk space is so much cheaper than RAM chips, it also has a nice economic benefit. The read/write speed of a hard drive is much slower than RAM, and the technology of a hard drive is not geared toward accessing small pieces of data at a time. If your system has to rely too heavily on virtual memory, you will notice a significant performance drop. The key is to have enough RAM to handle everything you tend to work on simultaneously. Then, the only time you feel the slowness of virtual memory is when there's a slight pause when you're changing tasks. When that's the case, virtual memory is perfect. When it is not the case, the operating system has to constantly swap information back and forth between RAM and the hard disk. This is called thrashing, and it can make your computer feel incredibly slow. The area of the hard disk that stores the RAM image is called a page file. It holds pages of RAM on the hard disk, and the operating system moves data back and forth between the page file and RAM. On a Windows machine, page files have a SWP extension. Windows 98 is an example of a typical operating system that has virtual memory. Windows 98 has an intelligent virtual memory manager that uses a default setting to help Windows allocate hard drive space for virtual memory as needed. For most circumstances, this should meet your needs, but you may want to manually configure virtual memory, especially if you have more than one physical hard drive or speed-critical applications. System resources. Many people can get confused about running out of memory when they get the message that the system resources are out of memory. In many cases, an out-of-memory message is misleading, since your whole system really did not run out of memory. What this really means is that certain systems in your computer are running low on memory. Windows maintains an area of memory for operating system resources. The maximum size of this area is 128K, in 264K areas. Windows uses this area of memory to store fonts, bitmaps, drop-down menu lists and other on-screen information used by each application. When any program begins running, it uses up some space in the system resources area in memory. But, as you exit, some programs do not give back system resources they were temporarily using. Eventually the system will crash as it runs out of memory. The crash happens sometimes if you start and close many programs, even the same ones, without a periodic reboot. This is what Microsoft calls a resource leak or memory leak. When you tell your system to exit a program, the program is supposed to give back the resources, memory, it was using. However, programs are written by humans and mistakes can happen. The program may not give back all of the resources to the operating system. This failing to give back is the memory leak, eventually leading to a message that your computer is low on resources. Memory leaks can also be caused by programs that automatically load every time you boot your system. The system resources problem is something you might have to live with until the misbehaving application is found. If you are sure a certain application is causing the problem, be sure to contact the software vendor. The best preventive maintenance is to periodically reboot your system. RAM. Random access memory, RAM, is the best known form of computer memory. RAM is considered random access because you can access any memory cell directly if you know the row and column that intersect at that cell. The opposite of RAM is serial access memory, SAM. SAM stores data as a series of memory cells that can only be accessed sequentially, like a cassette tape. If the data is not in the current location, each memory cell is checked until the needed data is found. SAM works very well for memory buffers, where the data is normally stored in the order in which it will be used. A good example is the texture buffer memory on a video card. RAM data, on the other hand, can be accessed in any order. Similar to a microprocessor, a memory chip is an integrated circuit, IC, made of millions of transistors and capacitors. In the most common form of computer memory, dynamic random access memory, DRAM, a transistor and a capacitor are paired to create a memory cell, which represents a single bit of data. The capacitor holds the bit of information, a 0 or a 1. The transistor acts as a switch that lets the control circuitry on the memory chip read the capacitor or change its state. A capacitor is like a small bucket that is able to store electrons. To store a 1 in the memory cell, the bucket is filled with electrons. To store a 0, it is emptied. The problem with the capacitor's bucket is that it has a leak. In a matter of a few milliseconds, a full bucket becomes empty. Therefore, for dynamic memory to work, Either the CPU or the memory controller has to come along and recharge all of the capacitors holding a 1 before they discharge. To do this, the memory controller reads the memory and then writes it right back. This refresh operation happens automatically thousands of times per second. This refresh operation is where dynamic RAM gets its name. Dynamic RAM has to be dynamically refreshed all of the time or it forgets what it is holding. The downside of all of this refreshing is that it takes time and slows down the memory. Memory cells are etched onto a silicon wafer in an array of columns, bit lines, and rows, word lines. The intersection of a bit line and word line constitutes the address of the memory cell. DRAM works by sending a charge through the appropriate column, CAS, to activate the transistor at each bit in the column. When writing, the roll lines contain the state the capacitor should take on. When reading, the sense amplifier determines the level of charge in the capacitor. If it is more than 50%, it reads it as a 1, otherwise it reads it as a 0. The counter tracks the refresh sequence based on which rows have been accessed in what order. The length of time necessary to do all this is so short that it is expressed in nanoseconds, billionths of a second. A memory chip rating of 70 ns means that it takes 70 nanoseconds to completely read and recharge each cell. Memory cells alone would be worthless without some way to get information in and out of them. So the memory cells have a whole support infrastructure of other specialized circuits. These circuits perform functions such as identifying each row and column, row address select and column address select. Keeping track of the refresh sequence, counter. Reading and restoring the signal from a cell, sense amplifier. Telling a cell whether it should take a charge or not, write enable. Other functions of the memory controller include a series of tasks that include identifying the type, speed and amount of memory and checking for errors. Static RAM uses a completely different technology. In static RAM, a form of flip-flop holds each bit of memory. A flip-flop for a memory cell takes 4 or 6 transistors along with some wiring, but never has to be refreshed. This makes static RAM significantly faster than dynamic RAM. However, because it has more parts, a static memory cell takes up a lot more space on a chip than a dynamic memory cell. Therefore, you get less memory per chip, and that makes static RAM a lot more expensive. Static RAM is fast and expensive, and dynamic RAM is less expensive and slower. Static RAM is used to create the CPU's speed-sensitive cache. Dynamic RAM forms the larger system RAM space. Memory chips in desktop computers originally used a pin configuration called Dual Inline Package, DIP. This pin configuration could be soldered into holes on the computer's motherboard or plugged into a socket that was soldered on the motherboard. This method worked fine when computers typically operated on a couple of megabytes or less of RAM, but as the need for memory grew, the number of chips needing space on the motherboard increased. The solution was to place the memory chips, along with all of the support components, on a separate printed circuit board, PCB, that could then be plugged into a special connector, memory bank, on the motherboard. Most of these chips use a small outline J-lead, SOJ, pin configuration, but quite a few manufacturers use the thin small outline package, TSOP, configuration as well. The key difference between these newer pin types and the original DIP configuration is that SOJ and TSOP chips are surface mounted to the PCB. In other words, the pins are soldered directly to the surface of the board, not inserted in holes or sockets. Memory chips are normally only available as part of a card called a module. You've probably seen memory listed as 8x32 or 4x16. These numbers represent the number of the chips multiplied by the capacity of each individual chip, which is measured in megabits, MB, or 1 million bits. Take the result and divide it by 8 to get the number of megabytes on that module. For example, 4x32 means that the module has 4 32 megabit chips. Multiply 4x32 and you get 128 megabits. Since we know that a byte has 8 bits, we need to divide our result of 128 by 8. Our result is 16 megabytes. It's been said that you can never have enough money. The same holds true for RAM, especially if you do a lot of graphics-intensive work or gaming. Next to the CPU itself, RAM is the most important factor in computer performance. If you don't have enough, adding RAM can make more of a difference than getting a new CPU. If your system responds slowly or accesses the hard drive constantly, then you need to add more RAM. If you are running Windows XP, Microsoft recommends 128 MB as the minimum RAM requirement. At 64 MB, you may experience frequent application problems. For optimal performance with standard desktop applications, 256 MB is recommended. If you are running Windows 95-98, you need a bare minimum of 32 MB, and your computer will work much better with 64 MB. Windows NT/2000 needs at least 64 MB, and it will take everything you can throw at it, so you'll probably want 128 MB or more. Linux works happily on a system with only 4 MB of RAM. If you plan to add X Windows or do much serious work, however, you'll probably want 64 MB. Mac OS X systems should have a minimum of 128 MB, or for optimal performance, 512 MB. The amount of RAM listed for each system above is estimated for normal usage, accessing the internet, word processing, standard home/office applications and light entertainment. If you do computer-rated design, CAD, 3D modeling/animation or heavy data processing, or if you are a serious gamer, then you will probably need more RAM. You may also need more RAM if your computer acts as a server of some sort, web pages, database, application, FTP or network. Another question is how much VRAM you want on your video card. Almost all cards that you can buy today have at least 16 MB of RAM. This is normally enough to operate in a typical office environment. You should probably invest in a 32 MB or better graphics card if you want to do any of the following. Play realistic games. Capture and edit video. Create 3D graphics. Work in a high resolution, full color environment. Design full color illustrations. When shopping for video cards, remember that your monitor and computer must be capable of supporting the card you choose. Computer memory. You already know that the computer in front of you has memory. What you may not know is that most of the electronic items you use every day have some form of memory also. Here are just a few examples of the many items that use memory. Cell phones, PDAs, game consoles, car radios, VCRs, TVs. Each of these devices uses different types of memory in different ways. Although memory is technically any form of electronic storage, it is used most often to identify fast, temporary forms of storage. If your computer's CPU had to constantly access the hard drive to retrieve every piece of data it needs, it would operate very slowly. When the information is kept in memory, the CPU can access it much more quickly. Most forms of memory are intended to store data temporarily. The CPU accesses memory according to a distinct hierarchy. Whether it comes from permanent storage, the hard drive, or input, the keyboard, most data goes in random access memory, RAM, first. The CPU then stores pieces of data it will need to access, often in a cache, and maintains certain special instructions in the register. All of the components in your computer, such as the CPU, the hard drive and the operating system, work together as a team, and memory is one of the most essential parts of this team. From the moment you turn your computer on until the time you shut it down, your CPU is constantly using memory. Let's take a look at a typical scenario. You turn the computer on. The computer loads data from read-only memory, ROM, and performs a power-on self-test, POST, to make sure all the major components are functioning properly. As part of this test, the memory controller checks all of the memory addresses with a quick read/write operation to ensure that there are no errors in the memory chips. Read/write means that data is written to a bit and then read from that bit. The computer loads the basic input/output system, BIOS, from ROM. The BIOS provides the most basic information about storage devices, boot sequence, security, plug and play, auto device recognition, capability and a few other items. The computer loads the operating system, OS, from the hard drive into the system's RAM. Generally, the critical parts of the operating system are maintained in RAM as long as the computer is on. This allows the CPU to have immediate access to the operating system, which enhances the performance and functionality of the overall system. When you open an application, it is loaded into RAM. To conserve RAM usage, many applications load only the essential parts of the program initially and then load other pieces as needed. After an application is loaded, any files that are opened for use in that application are loaded into RAM. When you save a file and close the application, the file is written to the specified storage device, and then it and the application are purged from RAM. In the list above, every time something is loaded or opened, it is placed into RAM. This simply means that it has been put in the computer's temporary storage area so that the CPU can access that information more easily. The CPU requests the data it needs from RAM, processes it and writes new data back to RAM in a continuous cycle. In most computers, this shuffling of data between the CPU and RAM happens millions of times every second. When an application is closed, it and any accompanying files are usually purged, deleted, from RAM to make room for new data. If the changed files are not saved to a permanent storage device before being purged, they are lost. Fast, powerful CPUs need quick and easy access to large amounts of data in order to maximize their performance. If the CPU cannot get to the data it needs, it literally stops and waits for it. Modern CPUs running at speeds of about 1 GHz can consume massive amounts of data, potentially billions of bytes per second. The problem that computer designers face is that memory that can keep up with a 1 GHz CPU is extremely expensive, much more expensive than anyone can afford in large quantities. Computer designers have solved the cost problem by tiering memory, using expensive memory in small quantities and then backing it up with larger quantities of less expensive memory. The cheapest form of read/write memory in wide use today is the hard disk. Hard disks provide large quantities of inexpensive, permanent storage. You can buy hard disk space for pennies per megabyte, but it can take a good bit of time, approaching a second, to read a megabyte off a hard disk. Because storage space on a hard disk is so cheap and plentiful, it forms the final stage of a CPU's memory hierarchy, called virtual memory. The next level of the hierarchy is RAM. The bit size of a CPU tells you how many bytes of information it can access from RAM at the same time. For example, a 16-bit CPU can process 2 bytes at a time, 1 byte equals 8 bits, so 16 bits equals 2 bytes. And a 64-bit CPU can process 8 bytes at a time. Megahertz, is a measure of a CPU's processing speed, or clock cycle, in millions per second. So, a 32-bit 800 MHz Pentium 3 can potentially process 4 bytes simultaneously, 800 million times per second, possibly more based on pipelining. The goal of the memory system is to meet those requirements. A computer's system RAM alone is not fast enough to match the speed of the CPU. That is why you need a cache, discussed later. However, the faster RAM is the better. Most chips today operate with a cycle rate of 50 to 70 nanoseconds. The read/write speed is typically a function of the type of RAM used, such as DRAM, SDRAM, RAMBUS. System RAM speed is controlled by bus width and bus speed. Bus width refers to the number of bits that can be sent to the CPU simultaneously, and bus speed refers to the number of times a group of bits can be sent each second. A bus cycle occurs every time data travels from memory to the CPU. For example, a 100 MHz 32-bit bus is theoretically capable of sending 4 bytes, 32 bits divided by 8 equals 4 bytes, of data to the CPU 100 million times per second. While a 66 MHz 16-bit bus can send 2 bytes of data 66 million times per second. If you do the math, You'll find that simply changing the bus width from 16 bits to 32 bits and the speed from 66 MHz to 100 MHz in our example allows for 3 times as much data, 400 million bytes versus 132 million bytes, passing through to the CPU every second. In reality, RAN doesn't usually operate at optimum speed. Latency changes the equation radically. Latency refers to the number of clock cycles needed to read a bit of information. For example, RAN rated at 100 MHz is capable of sending a bit in 0.00000001 seconds, but may take 0.00000005 seconds to start the read process for the first bit. To compensate for latency, CPUs use a special technique called burst mode. Burst mode depends on the expectation that data requested by the CPU will be stored in sequential memory cells. The memory controller anticipates that whatever the CPU is working on will continue to come from this same series of memory addresses, so it reads several consecutive bits of data together. This means that only the first bit is subject to the full effect of latency. Reading successive bits takes significantly less time. The rated burst mode of memory is normally expressed as 4 numbers separated by dashes. The first number tells you the number of clock cycles needed to begin a read operation, the second, third and fourth numbers tell you how many cycles are needed to read each consecutive bit in the row, also known as the word line. For example, 5111 tells you that it takes 5 cycles to read the first bit and 1 cycle for each bit after that. Obviously, the lower these numbers are, the better the performance of the memory. Burst mode is often used in conjunction with pipelining, another means of minimizing the effects of latency. Pipelining organizes data retrieval into a sort of assembly line process. The memory controller simultaneously reads one or more words from memory, sends the current word or words to the CPU and writes one or more words to memory cells. Used together, burst mode and pipelining can dramatically reduce the lag caused by latency. So why wouldn't you buy the fastest, widest memory you can get? The speed and width of the memory's bus should match the system's bus. You can use memory designed to work at 100 MHz in a 66 MHz system, but it will run at the 66 MHz speed of the bus, so there is no advantage, and 32-bit memory won't fit on a 16-bit bus. Even with a wide and fast bus, it still takes longer for data to get from the memory card to the CPU than it takes for the CPU to actually process the data. That's where caches come in. Conclusion. Computer operating systems are the basic building blocks for computer users. It is the brain that allows the computer to operate and can be quite important. As we have shown you, there are many types of operating systems, and which one you choose is a personal decision. Each OS has its own specific advantages and disadvantages. What you need to do is look at the features each has to offer and then pick the one that best suits your needs. You don't have to be stuck with Windows anymore if you don't want to be. Now you have a choice. When you have a better understanding of what operating systems can offer, you'll be better informed to make your choice. While the terminology can be complicated, we hope that you now understand that each system is really built with the user in mind, which is the most important component to operating system designers. So next time you log on to your computer, remember that behind the scenes there are many, many things going on that you can't see. Try to imagine your computer usage without these things. It is truly magical to be living in the computer age. Your operating system just makes it easier and more enjoyable. There's no big secret to an operating system, but now, hopefully, you know more than you did before, now that operating systems have been uncovered.